Blog Talk Radio.
Paperback Writer.
Well, hello, everybody. This is the Writer's Lounge, where we showcase new authors. And this is show number 106, and it is January 10th, 2022. I'm your host, Tom Riddell. A brief intro to today's show, having on author Maya Catherine, and she's going to be telling us about her book, An Apology to My Demons. She'll be on a little bit here, about 15 minutes after the hour. A little brief intro there, and then now more about us. Here's where you can find us out there. Find us on Facebook at the Writer's Lounge, showcasing new authors. Find the book reviews of all of our current shows over at thomasriddell.net. That's thomasriddell.net. In the blog section and on the on-demand radio shows can be found there on the podcast page as well, or go over to the Blog Talk Radio site and search for the Writer's Lounge. Find me on Twitter at TomRiddell56, and our email is writerslounge2020@yahoo.com. And if you want to be a guest on the show and have your book reviewed, put in guest request in the subject line, and we will get back to you. Special note, we can also now be heard on your Alexa device. Subscribe to Apple Podcast and ask her to play the Writer's Lounge, showcasing new authors. I'd also like to put in a plug for Goodreads and Reads eDiscovery. They both do a great deal to help authors and readers alike, and I also review books on both sites as well. Upcoming authors on the Writer's Lounge on January 24th, 2022, we're going to have on best-selling author Luke Romaine. He will be here for his second visit in over 10 years to talk to us about all that he's been doing since then, and we'll learn more about his book, Ash. It's an amazing story and an amazing character. On February 7th, Frederick Reynolds will be our guest to talk about his book, Black, White, and Gray All Over, A Black Man's Odyssey in Life and Law Enforcement, a true story about what it's like to be a cop. And this show is one you don't want to miss. Hope you'll tune in to those exciting upcoming shows. And let's see what we've got here in the Writer's Topics is our next segment of the show. And today, when writers finally decide to sit down to write a book, they have most likely devoured all kinds of advice as to how to write the best-selling novel. I am one of those people, by the way. One of the biggest pieces of advice I and others have heard is to show, don't tell. And I've often wondered, what exactly does that mean? When we start writing a narrative to a story, how do we present it, and what's it mean to show? Well, in the clip I'm going to play from Diane Callahan, which you can find the full version on YouTube under How to Show, Not Tell, she explains with several examples of what showing and not telling means. It's about 10 minutes long, and after that, we'll be back to chat with author Maya Catherine. So stay with us after this clip.
The girl was scared of the wilderness, her heart pounding at every frightening noise. But suddenly her fear disappeared. She touched the ground, and it felt like her new guardian. What's wrong with this picture? Well, for one, this passage doesn't actually paint much of a picture, and it fails to make me feel anything as a reader. That's the core problem with writing that relies too much on telling. We're told the girl is scared, that the noises are frightening, and that this place feels like a guardian. Yet there isn't much evidence to back up those claims. Show, don't tell is a phrase you've probably heard often in the writing community. Author K.M. Weiland best captures the distinction. Showing dramatizes, telling summarizes. But it can be hard to identify harmful instances of telling in your own writing. Telling is not inherently bad. In fact, all novels are a blend of telling and showing. You don't always need to show instead of tell. If that were the case, all stories would be ridiculously long and filled with unnecessary descriptions. Telling is useful for quickly conveying the passage of time or presenting important facts to the reader without belaboring the point. Take a look at the opening of the children's novel, The Secret Garden, by Frances Hodgson Burnett.
When Mary Lennox was sent to Misselthwaite Manor to live with her uncle, everybody said she was the most disagreeable-looking child ever seen. It was true, too. She had a little thin face and a little thin body, thin light hair and a sour expression. Her hair was yellow, and her face was yellow, because she had been born in India and had always been ill in one way or another.
We're told some information about Mary being a disagreeable-looking child who's always been ill, but that statement is immediately supported by the visual proof of her thin face and hair, along with her sour expression. If someone flags your writing for too much telling, that likely means you need to provide details or a strong narrative voice to make the reader feel something. Good writing invites the reader to visualize the scene and experience the emotions themselves, rather than being told how to feel. In his TED Talk, The Clues to a Great Story, Pixar writer and director Andrew Stanton proposes the unifying theory of 2+2. He says, make the audience put things together. Don't give them four, give them 2+2. The opening of relies entirely on showing the audience the equation without giving them the answer, and he describes why that approach is effective.
Storytelling without dialogue, it's the purest form of cinematic storytelling. It's the most inclusive approach you can take. It confirms something I really had a hunch on, is that the audience actually wants to work for their meal. They just don't want to know that they're doing that. That's your job as a storyteller, is to hide the fact that you're making them work for their meal. We're born problem solvers. We're compelled to deduce and to deduct, because that's what we do in real life. It's this well-organized absence of information that draws us in. There's a reason that we're all attracted to an infant or a puppy. It's not just that they're damn cute. It's because they can't completely express what they're thinking and what their intentions are. And it's like a magnet. We can't stop ourselves from wanting to complete the sentence and fill it in.
The same principle is true for other non-visual modes of storytelling. The key to making your audience care in fiction is to imply your meaning, rather than always pointing it out. Readers love the process of discovery and solving puzzles. Before we dive into some practical strategies, I want to take a two-minute detour to explore the origins of Show Don't Tell as a writing mantra, since it's not often discussed. In his 2004 book, Creative Writing and the New Humanities, scholar Paul Dawson describes how the novel transformed across the 19th and 20th centuries with the rise of realism as a literary movement. Realism aims to tell the stories of ordinary people with complete honesty rather than romanticizing them. Dawson notes, from Flaubert onwards, the trajectory of the novel is often regarded as the development of techniques to impersonalize the narrator in order to efface the presence of the implied author and dramatize as much of the action as possible. Literary critic Percy Lubbock praised those 19th century realists for giving the novel a defined aesthetic, and it's his 1921 book, The Craft of Fiction, that likely popularized the idea of showing versus telling. He says, the art of fiction does not begin until the novelist thinks of his story as a matter to be shown, to be so exhibited that it will tell itself. Authors like Virginia Woolf both praised and criticized Lubbock for confining the novel writing craft to a formal system. His ideas were incredibly influential in the literary world. Basically, the intention of this advice is to turn the author into an invisible narrator and avoid breaking the reader's immersion in the story. Janice Hardy makes a similar observation in her 2016 writing guide, Understanding Show, Don't Tell. A common rule of thumb, as long as it feels like the character is thinking it, you're usually okay. But as soon as it sounds like the author butting in to explain things, you've probably fallen into telling. If you want readers to experience the story's emotions on a gut level, you've got to know when to show. Generally speaking, moments involving emotions, opinions, or sensations are best shown rather than told. Here are 6 guiding principles for a stronger showing. Number 1, use evidence to support your claims. If a narrator says her husband is a kind-hearted person, or the protagonist believes his best friend is guilty of murder, what led them to that conclusion? Give the reader the same evidence the character uses when it comes to assumptions or opinions. Author Chuck Pumpernickel advises a ban on thought verbs like thinks, knows, understands, realizes, believes, wants, remembers, and imagines. He talks about unpacking scenes so that the reader feels and thinks what the characters are feeling and thinking. He gives this example. Instead of saying, Adam knew Gwen liked him, you'll have to say, between classes, Gwen was always leaned on his locker when he'd go to open it. She'd roll her eyes and shove off of one foot, leaving a black heel mark on the painted metal, but she also loved the smell of her perfume. The combination lock would still be warm from her ass, and the next break, Gwen would be leaned there again. Polonik adds, instead of characters knowing anything, you must now present the details that allow the reader to know them. Instead of a character wanting something, you must now describe the thing so that the reader wants it. You can pull readers into the story by presenting evidence, whether that's a visual detail or a piece of dialogue, and letting them come to their own conclusions about the impression you're trying to create. Number 2, replace the abstract with the concrete. In particular, be careful about directly stating a character's feelings. The blog Novel Writing Help by Harvey Chapman gives a great before and after example. Telling, after his first kiss with Samantha, Toby walked home feeling happier than he'd ever felt in all his 13 years. Showing, after his first kiss with Samantha, Toby couldn't keep the goofy grin off his face all the way home. When he came to the front gate, he jumped clean over it, didn't come close to tripping. Chapman further explains why the changes work. Happiness is an abstract concept and needs to be demonstrated, shown, not told, with concrete details, like the wide grin and the gate jumping. So you can often replace emotions with actions that allow the reader to infer the emotion. Also be wary of descriptions that use opinion-related adjectives, like beautiful or strange. In a first draft, I might write, the dark forest felt eerie. Okay, maybe it feels eerie to the character, but the reader needs to feel it too. I need to convince the reader that it's eerie using evidence. The forest hummed with the cries of children long dead. That's better. Sufficiently eerie. Replace adjective labels with details that allow the reader to interpret the atmosphere on their own. A trick for identifying when you're in abstract territory is to ask a question that Jeff Gert poses in his book, The First 50 Pages. Can the camera see it? Almost all examples of showing contain a detail that can be visualized, although you'll often want to combine those visuals with smell, touch, taste, and sound. author Jerry Jenkins provides great examples of replacing abstract emotions with concrete actions on his blog. Cold, don't tell me, show me. Your character pulls her collar up, tightens her scarf, shoves her hands deep into her pockets, turns her face away from the biting wind. Tired? He can yawn, groan, stretch. His eyes can look puffy. His shoulders could slump. Another character might say, didn't you sleep last night? You look shot. Another way of thinking about this camera idea is to consider the effect and not the cause of a particular detail. Take a look at these additional examples from Jerry Jenkins. Telling, the temperature fell and the ice reflected the sun. Showing, Bill's nose burned in the frigid air and he squinted against the sun reflecting off the street. Telling, Susie was blind. Showing, Susie felt for the bench with a white cane. Telling, it was late fall. Showing, leaves crunched beneath his feet. In the first example, the cold temperature is the cause of specific effects on the character, namely Bill's nose burning in the frigid air. Instead of being stated outright, the details are instead shown through how the character interacts with the world around them, like leaves crunching beneath their feet, which makes the scene more visual.
Okay, I hope you enjoyed that little clip. Like I say, you can get more from Diane Callahan. Just go to your YouTube and look for How to Show, Not Tell. And now on to the main event. A guest author today, of course, is Maya Catherine, and she wrote Apology to My Demons. I want to remind everybody out there that if you're listening to the show live, you can give us a call in and talk to Maya. And the area code is 914-219-0868. And the book is An Apology to My Demons. And here is my partial review of An Apology to My Demons. An automobile strikes a guardrail and it ends up in a lake. The driver is trapped. She begins to see her life flash before her as the water slowly seeps in. But it's her fears and her past demons and monsters that consume her thoughts in the waning moments of her life. Chaos and turmoil had been ruling her for years, a direct result of being bullied and mistreated during her childhood, but those monsters and demons were kept hidden. Others saw a productive and self-reliant person. The truth was she was emotionally broken, suffering from low self-esteem and from being in codependent toxic relationships. In order to cope, she shoved those skeletons away. Now they were back. Awful memories surfaced when she watched the water enter her car, ready to drown her. A repository of dead dreams, dead hopes, broken promises, betrayals, lies, and worse, violations of body, violations of trust, and violations of innocence. The author pulled me into the story and kept me there. Empathy flowed, and I smiled when I found the surprise at the end. I absolutely loved it. And now it is my pleasure to welcome Maya Catherine to the Writer's Lounge broadcast. It was as we now push the magic button to open the doors to the Writer's Lounge, and with a little bit of a click and a little bit of magic, I think she should be there. Maya, you're there?
Yes. Hi, Tom. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. How are you doing tonight?
Good, good. And it's Maya. Sorry, I didn't make that clearer. I know the
Maya.
Spelling is different, but you could. It's Maya, yeah.
It's Maya. Okay. It threw me with the M and the A and the I.
I know. It was trying to be original, but I should have made that clear. So it's on
okay.
me.
It's okay. And tell us a little bit more about yourself and what or who inspired you to be an author and a writer.
Okay, hi. So thank you so much for having me. It is an honor, and I'm very, very thankful for the opportunity. So what can I say? I've always written since I was a child. And, you know, I started doing poetry, as with many people, and it was just, you know, just, I guess, putting my feelings down on paper, my hopes, my dreams, my despair on paper. And over the years, I kind of stepped away from writing a little bit, just followed, you know, the typical college, work, kids, life. But, you know, the love of writing and the love of emotional healing, to be honest with you, I've always felt I had a purpose of helping others heal emotionally. So that never really left. That kept nudging at me, and I finally made the decision. You know, once I was able to get to a good place with my own healing, I finally decided that, you know, my wisdom was not for me to keep. None of our wisdom are for us to keep. And I needed to share my, you know, journey in case it couldn't inspire somebody else to heal. So that's how I got from, you know, the little girl writing poetry in the blue turquoise diary. There's actually a turquoise diary. I still have it. And from there to an apology to my demons. So that's kind of the journey right there.
Very good. And it's a pleasure to have read your book and to now have the opportunity to talk to you. And this may be a spoiler question. So our listeners, if you haven't read the book and are listening, read it and then come back to listen to it in our archives. But you did allude to the idea that the character in the book is actually you. But did you share all of the same experiences that your character did?
Yes. I always tell people because, you know, the subject matter can be a little, you know, it's personal, sensitive topics. I mean, I talk about violations of bodies. So, you know, these are very emotional subjects. And the demons, I had them all. The hardships, I felt them all. Because, you know, a lot of the people I grew up around are still alive. I it wasn't verbatim, you know, exactly the experience that I had, but the hardships are the same. So if I talk about violations of body, you know, maybe I mention Peter in the book, it's another name, but it happened, you know.
Yes.
So I did experience all of that, and I experienced the struggles and the blowing up, like, you know, the book starts with there's a monster inside her. That's me. That was me. I experienced all of those things and the turmoil and, you know, maybe not necessarily a crash in the water, but it was my health having to go to the hospital and the doctor saying if you didn't come today, you were going to die. That actually did happen to me.
Right.
So, you know, so again, just for the sake of privacy and out of respect for, you know, the people I grew up with, certain scenarios were changed, but the demons, every single one of them, the hardships, the pain, the despair, and the victories are all my experience.
Right. And what was it like for you to actually get in the process of bringing all those memories back? Was that a painful experience for you, or how did you deal with that?
Oh, my God, Tom. Like, thank you for asking that. It was super hard. I started actually writing a different book, which was where I am right now. And nobody's ever fully healed, okay? I think some hardships in life just scar you for life. It doesn't mean you suffer for life, but they stay with you. And a lot of times it's a daily decision to look on the bright side, to be positive. So, you know, I started writing about where I am now, which is confident, positive, hopeful, you know, less codependent and things like that. Again, I'm not perfect in any way, but way better than I used to be. So I started writing that, and then I thought, you know, I can't start where I am. I need, you know, life doesn't work like that. I need to show my scars. I need to show people how it all started, and then they could follow the healing process with me. So I switched the book, you know, around, and switched the title, and had to go one by one to the bad experiences, the hardships. And again, some of my personal hardships are not even in there. There are more. But these were the ones I felt a lot of people could relate to, and I had to go back. So one by one, it wasn't really easy. However, they say, you know, when you can talk about a past experience without crying or getting too emotional, it means that you have some level of healing. And I can say, it didn't bring me down like it used to, you know. It didn't crush me
right,
like it used to think about it. And, you know, so it wasn't as horrible as I thought it would be, but it wasn't, you know, it still was going back to that. So, you know, it's a so-so process, but it was worth it because I knew that my purpose was to have people, especially, you know, with the little lines I add, you know, at the end of each chapter, the section where people can actually write their own thoughts. That was important to me. So I knew why I was writing. I was writing for a little girl and a little boy and an older person, an older woman and an older man out there, you know, that haven't healed those things. And I knew that it was worth, you know, any discomfort I was going through going back to those events.
Right. It's very interesting because I had heard the other day someone talking about habits, and they had said that when you develop habits, such as you're mentioning feeling positive and doing a positive things and try to, you know, not focus on the negative, that once you do that repetitively enough, it becomes a habit, and then eventually you just move into that other realm and the old self or that those old problems, even though they're still there and you never really forget them, you're able to break away from all that negativity and move into, as you say, move into the light. I find it very interesting how the human mind can work that way to bring us to that point.
Yeah.
But when a person, talking more about, you know, relationships as you've experienced them, when a person or you enter into a relationship, what triggers that it might be toxic relationship before it even gets started? Can you give us an example?
Well, that's a good question, actually. I, you know, throughout my own healing, my own research, like I've read so many books, went to so many seminars. I think there's a part in the book where I talk about, you know, addiction to seminars, right? It's to motivational speaking seminars and stuff like that. I went through all of that. And I mean, maybe, let me not use the word addiction, but the, you know, just being attracted to going to so many of the, looking for a lifeline, basically. So I went through all of that. And, you know, I've learned about, and I've read about, and from my own experience too, that a lot of relationships are just mirrors of what, you know, we feel on the inside and what needs to be healed on the inside. So, you know, for me, and as I tell people, unfortunately, it's not something that we figure out right away, you know?
Right.
And upon reflecting and looking at our patterns and our outcomes in relationships, that we can see, oh my gosh, like I'm following the, you know, same thing is happening to me all the time. And then, so self-reflection for me is huge. And I know some people, you know, meditation, or some people say, you know, use other words, but, and I respect all of those things. And if it works for you, fine. But for me, self-reflection is a word that applies to me a little better. And I do that on a regular basis. So when you start looking at your week, your month, your year, and you see that you had, you know, the relationship brought you more down days and, you know, not feeling your best and your spirit, you know, there is a point where your spirit is not honored that you feel it. We all feel it. We all feel when our spirit is not honored. And it's one thing to have a relationship where, you know, maybe you don't get your way or you're not happy about something. And it's different when it's your spirit that's not honored. And usually manifests in guilt, you know, like us feeling that we let ourselves down. You know, it manifests in not being able to be authentic. You know, it manifests in feeling the same fears that we did as a child, you know. So somebody that reminds you of your toxic mom or your toxic father, you know, or whatever teacher. You know, those little things, you know, start red flags, you know, that start telling you that something's not right here, something's not right here. But like I said to people the other day, I was having this discussion with someone, and I told them, you know, we need to be a little bit more understanding that people don't get those things right away. It's, you know, it's after being hurt and disappointed a few times that we usually get the lessons. So that's why, again, I decided to write my book this way, because I said, you know, there's able to be like the motivational quotes, you know, like walk away when something is toxic. That's the quote, right? And then your experience is being in the toxicity. There's a gap there that people really don't talk about. And that's why, you know, people go to those seminars and come out and nothing can change, because nobody talks about, okay, there's mud and quicksand and two steps forward and one step back in between. So Yeah, I guess self-reflection for me is one of the main tools that I recommend to everyone. You know, look at your week, look at your month with someone and see, you know, did you let your spirit down? And you'll know. If you listen to your gut, intuition, however you want to call it, you'll know. You'll know when you are don't honor.
Right, so it's,
you know,
it's not
that
so much.
For me is,
yeah, and I was going to say, it's not so much that you're looking at the other person to see what's wrong with the other person. You're kind of reflecting, as you say, looking in yourself to see how you're reacting to that other person. And that will tell you, because it's a mirror, as you say. You hold up the mirror and you're seeing yourself. And that's really who you're talking to is yourself, not so much the other person. Yeah,
absolutely. And it's not to take blame, but it's not to take responsibility away from somebody else. Because sometimes, you know, you need to detach yourself from somebody. But, you know, if you look at to the point where, why am I tolerating this? Why am I accepting this? You know, people are who they are. And if you look at that, then you see what you need to heal. And once you do, you will not attract that type of person. Because, you know, we attract who we are, you know.
Sure. And in the book, you wrote about the character. This is what you wrote. Suffering was what she was used to. And unbeknownst to her, she sought situations that mirrored the emotional wounds she had not healed. In love, she kept following patterns that always ended with her having a broken heart. I think you pretty much explained it in the last question that you answered. What does it take to really love again after you've been wounded? I mean,
oh my gosh.
self-reflection is good, but yeah.
Well, I think, you know what, I mean, to be honest, like I said, I'm still a work in progress like a lot of people, and that's the elusive, you know, question that a lot of people are still waiting for. For me, you know, after, you know, healing, because it was like 2 years or a year of like really going down, not socializing, just staying on my own, trying to heal that. You know, at the end of the healing, like the most important part, I really had to be just take care of responsibilities, basically, you know, work, kids, everything, and then just disappear to heal. So, you know, after all of that, you expect, okay, I'm good now and I can trust again and I can love again. And it takes a while for that to disappear too. And, you know, I guess one of the things that I've done to make a list of the assumptions I had about love, you know, based on my upbringing or what I experienced. And it was so surprising to see all these assumptions, you know, like men are always this way, or, you know, women always end up getting hurt, or this and that. Like, we don't realize we carry those things. Until we, you know, we sit down and we're like, well, you know, why do you feel, or you see somebody, why do I feel this way about this person? Or what does this comment from this person trigger me? And then you start making a list. And what I noticed is that I had a long list. I had a long list of things that, you know, that, how do you call it, like paradigms, you know, like your paradigm shift, you need that, right? So I had a long list of things that I believed. And one by one, you know, I started canceling them, you know, by trying to remember other people that were not like that, you know, by trying to remember, like one of the things that's the examples, you know, in my life of people that are not like that, guys are not like that, girls are not like that. So I had to do that work one by one of looking at the assumptions that I had. And a lot of time to find out the assumptions is how I felt. If I saw like a post about, you know, two people loving each other on Facebook, for example, and saying, yeah, right, you know, they only put that for Facebook. That's not, you know, that's a paradigm. That's an unhealthy mindset, right? Kind of cynical about, you know, whether or not that type of relationship is true. You know, so if, you know, sometimes we don't even realize how our psyche is telling us, you have a bias there, you know, or you have a preconceived notion here. So little things like that. So I had to kind of observe, and I saw the self-reflection. You know, we are our best teachers. So, you know, the way to really heal is to study yourself. Study your habits. Study your feelings. Study yourself. And then you make a map kind of, right, of how you are. And that's when you could start. So I guess for me, to answer your question, in my experience, the list was huge. And the list, you know, it's still there. It's way less than before. And I've noticed, too, like even on the friendship side, I've noticed now my friends are, you know, it's a better caliber of friends, you know, better type of friends and less friends, but better quality. And it's because I shifted, you know, the way I was looking at friendship. So I hope eventually that my relationship list kind of gets, you know, to the point where, you know, I can believe and trust again. But at the same time, though, I don't need it to get perfect. Like, I know I deserve love. So, and I don't need to be fully healed to have love. You know, I don't need to, like, pass a test, you know. I just have to keep loving myself and doing things for me to be happy. So, you know, and I honestly can tell you, I honestly know that I'm going to have that beautiful relationship, you know. So at this point, in the meantime, like, I didn't know that for sure at one point, but now I know. But I'm not trying to hurry it up either. So I'm like, you know, the more time passes, the more I heal, then the better it will be. That's kind of where I am. But I have those days where I'm like, you know, man, I wish, you know, I had those days. But it's less than before. I'm so grateful for my life now that it kind of takes more of my time, you know. But
yeah,
I suppose
I suppose too that we can get a little bit too analytical about our own feelings, and sometimes we just have to, you know, just let it go and
Earth.
Just go out there. Yeah. deep subject here: suicide. That's a strong answer.
Yeah.
That's a strong answer to life's problems. What is the answer, do you think, instead of suicide? I mean, how do you pull yourself back from being at that point?
Well, you know, I have in the back of my book and now in the front of my book just a list of hotlines for mental care and emotional care. And I always tell people before I even give any answer that, you know, if you need help, professional help, like clinical help, get it, you know. I just speak of my experiences, but I'm not an expert, so that's, I'll say that before I start answering anything. As far as me, you know, I've definitely been honest with there are times that I didn't really want to be here, you know, and I never really got to the point where I tried anything, but I had, you know, I got times where I was like, what's the point of this thing, you know, what's the point of being here and just suffering all the time? So I guess, you know, for me it was like, finding, you know, the answer, like finding the reasons why being here may, you know, may be worth it, and making a list. Again, I'm like a list person. So finding reasons why, you know, being here may be good. You know, what can be good about being here? Number one. Number two, you know, who depends on you? Or, and maybe that's not, you know, like right now I say, you know, your self-love has to come from, and self-worth has to come from what you give to yourself. So you shouldn't really put that on somebody. But at the same time, when you are deep in the, you know, in the hole, sometimes it's people depending on you that give you a reason to continue. So it's, you know, it's another thing to look at, you know, who will lose if you're not around. And, you know, one more thing I'll say is I always tell people, like, you didn't create yourself, so, you know, you should just give the universe a chance to show you how good it can be. And for me, until your last breath, you don't really know how good it can be. So I'm somebody who, you know, I if I quit, I wouldn't have learned what I had learned, you know. I wouldn't be here. And I don't put people down saying, you know, you're a coward if you contemplate that, because like I said, people's pains are people's pains, and I don't know what somebody's feeling. But at the same time, it's like, how do you know until you last breath? How do you know? There are things that you learn when you're 10, and then when you're 40, you're like, oh my God, like, this comes in handy now. I get it. Or I get why this friend left. Or I get why, you know, I didn't get accepted to this college because I ended up meeting, you know, the love of my life in this other college. Like, how do you know, you know?
Right.
How do you know what you're going through, how it could help you? So you might, you know, you might be the prisoner that kills himself on day 99 and they're going to be released on day 100. So
yes.
I always talk about, like, don't be the day 99 prisoner. you know, and for me, it's like, I tell people, if you cut your arm, you know, or the wound will close, right? I mean, it's a big recut, but eventually the wound will close by itself. If you're going to fall, your hands are going to come in front of you to try to save you from the pain. So we're built with something that is against pain, you know, and against, you know, getting hurt. Like, we're built with that and healing, right? We're built with that. So I look at nature and I look at myself as the guide. So if my body is built with a self-preserving mechanisms, you know, and my body is built with reflexes to protect me, then self-preservation should be my, you know, my goal too, you know? And
sure.
And I just follow that, and I'm like, you know, if pain was what I was supposed to have, then my body would just, the cut would just stay open. So, you know, I just take example from that, because sometimes you can't really find example from where you come from or from your experience. Everything kind of looks bad, right? But I always look at my body, at the nature, and I say, you know, if nature, even Mother Nature, you know, is self-preserving. So I'm like, if I'm built with self-preservation instincts, it's because I'm meant to self-preserve. So,
right.
You know, again, it's for me, if somebody needs help, get help. But for me, in combination of those three things is why I will never, you know, I will not do it. I will not do it.
Right.
I hope, I have so much hope for tomorrow, you know.
Right. Maya, Carl Jung said, until you make the young conscious, it will direct your life, and you will call it fate. I know people who have actually pushed back against a good life, or even what most people would consider a happy life, and they self-sabotage it to return to their old ways or to relationships that don't work. What's it take to know you can control your fate to actually improve your life and to address your demons?
Oh, thank you. I love that quote. And, you know, it's kind of like the premise of the book, right? So her demons, her inner demons, were driving her life, and she just thought she was at the wheel, but they were, you know. And I tell people the reasons why I really, really wanted to write this book is to tell people, you have a say in where your life goes. You know, you have a say. Now, at the same time, there is power in surrendering. There's power in the unknown, in a way, you know, the subconscious, right? The stuff that we can't think of, but that still, you know, are there. Like the universe, like climate. There's a lot of things that we don't understand. How, you know, the sun, how does the sun work? Like, we know how it works, but why? But who did, like, you know, who designed that, and why does it work like that? So there are certain things in life that we're not going to be able to explain. So, you know, having control of your life doesn't mean, you know, being able to decide everything, okay? So with that said, you're able to put your life in a path that is good for your spirit. And that's a combination of action, you know, and that's a combination of your belief system, of action, and of surrender, meaning accepting certain things in life will be certain ways and you can change them. But you are not meant to change everything. You're meant to make the best out of everything that comes in to your hands. So I'm Caribbean, right? So we play dominoes. We play a lot of dominoes. And dominoes, you shuffle the dominoes and then you just take, you know, seven. So whatever you have, you deal with that. You don't say, why did I get those seven? Why? You just try to make the best out of those. So, you know, that's a perfect example of what I said. The taking action, you pick the dominoes and you make decisions. Surrender, okay, this is what I have, so I'll work with that. You know, and also your belief system that, oh my God, like, you know, this game is rigged, it'll never work. If I don't have a double six, you know, I can never win. You know, the belief system, right? So yes, you can put your life in the path that you need to using those three things. But definitely, you know, being able to control your life doesn't mean controlling everything that comes in your life. It just means controlling your reaction to things, how you take it, and what you do with it. You know, that's more in our control. And even when I say in our control, you still have the subconscious sometimes, like, again, that you know where it's driving the bus. But the more you do self-love, the more you do your healing work, the more you do self-reflection, you'll start getting in line with the, you know, subconscious, unconscious, or whatever, and start, you know, bringing it into the conscious. And again,
right,
there's always going to be things that we don't know, but we don't need to know everything.
Right, and deal with the hand
you
that
know,
you were dealt, or the dominoes
yeah.
that you were given, as you said.
Exactly.
I love
exactly.
your writing and your descriptions, and you wrote here, this is really, really good, that I had to put it down here and read it, and it's here's
okay.
what you wrote. Something about the
okay.
soft bun, the crunch of lettuce and tomato, and the richness of mayo mixed with ketchup gave her the highest of highs. It gave her a foodgasm. That is an awesome description. How do you see your writing developing from here? Any good stories percolating in your head
oh.
to continue doing with that? Because I just love that. It was just excellent.
And you know what? You know what, Tom? I was listening to the segment before I came on, and about, you know, don't show and don't tell. And
yes.
and the lady actually she mentioned something about it. She's like, you know, use words to describe the feeling, you know, more than descriptive words, you know. So
right.
so instead of
right.
saying, you know, so it's kind of that, wasn't kind of that. I was thinking about that when I was listening to it. By the way, it was an awesome segment to play. I appreciate it a lot.
Yeah.
So yeah. What's next for me? My writing, definitely. I can say I've matured as a writer. The time that I wrote this book, was kind of pure emotions on paper. You know, it's
yeah.
just raw emotions, just you know, spewing out of me on paper, despair, joy, fear, everything, right? It was like a soup, an emotion soup, right? So
uh-huh.
since then, you know, and I'm proud of my book, and I love my book, and I've, you know, I've gotten, I mean, your review was excellent. I love it. Other people had reviewed it, and, you know, the feedback is excellent as well. So many people say, you know, this chapter was for me, you know, that chapter was for me. And some people say, I'm not going to say which chapter, but you were the chapter that was just for me. So I love when I hear that. I'm grateful.
Uh-huh.
But, so I feel like I'm mature, definitely. You know, I've listened to things like the piece that you played before, where, you know, I can look at the vocabulary, I can look at my, you know, my sentences, I can look at the techniques that I use now to write. And my second book is already in the works because now I need to talk about how, you know, and my second book is going to start in the hospital, right, when she's in the hospital, because, I, at the end of the book, I kind of skip, you know, from that moment to where she is now. She's feeling better.
Right.
She's still, but I didn't explain how. And I did it on purpose because I tell people I'm real. I just say the way it is. I'm not going to write a book and say everything happened in one book. Things take time. And it was important for me to show that things take time. So the second book was Sarah in the hospital and how she did, you know, how she went to the people, like, did she meet Mr. Peter, you know? Did she, you know, what? How did she do with the booze that was in her house, you know, the whole time?
Right.
How did she go to treatment? Did she get a therapist, you know, 2 steps forward, 1 step back? Did she relapse, you know, and stuff like that? So that's the second book. And I can see, you know, a little bit, again, the technique that I was, you know, the show and don't tell, I can see, you know, details about how the process was done. I can see maybe technical things as far as if she saw a therapist, like, you know, a little bit maybe some clinical stuff maybe. And but I definitely see this is being my life. This is my life. My life purpose is to write and speak about emotional healing. And hopefully, you know, after I'm gone, you know, the message will still be there and emotional healing will get its due justice and due, you know, attention, which it is getting now. I'm very grateful for that. But I feel like this is something they should teach in school, not only like, you know, how to make $5 million, but how to come back from betrayal, you know, how
right.
to come back from feeling, you know, unworthy, how to love a parent after a parent, you know, didn't love you the right way, you know, how to forgive your parents. How does
yeah, that's
it eat
more,
justice?
More valuable than money would be in being able to bring yourself back. That means a lot more than making money or anything that's material. You really need to focus on yourself
and
bring yourself back. Yeah.
Exactly. And material, you know, it's like I'm not going to be, you know, yeah, everybody wants a comfortable and happy and life that I want that too, you know, and but that's important as well. And before we used to have, you know, the grandparents, you know, kind of giving that teaching, but now the grandparents work, the parents work, everybody works. So it's like we kind of lost that wisdom generation. I don't know how to say it, but, you know, we lost
right.
that thing and there's not really that support. So the other day I spoke to the Boys and Girls Club, and those teens were so wonderful. They wrote me a letter. I cried. And they want me back, you know. And I said, because everybody needs that, and people are not getting it. So I definitely see myself going there, and I totally appreciate everybody like you that gives me an interview and lets me talk about the book. I appreciate you for you know, following your purpose and having this station and helping writers. Because, you know, we might talk about a book and somebody hears it that was, like you said, contemplating something. And that may be what they get out of this interview. So I
right.
so appreciate you. I'm grateful for you. And I'm grateful for the universe giving me the strength not to give up either. And
very
I'm
good.
I'm just gonna, you know, make the universe proud by keep pushing, you know.
Right.
I'm just gonna
Maya,
keep
what are your thoughts on whether new authors should self-publish or go the traditional route?
Wow. Okay, so that was a huge question for me because before being a writer, I was in corporate America or, you know, not, and, you know, at one point, and then I was in another industry, nothing with writing. I didn't know anything other than I like to write. So I had to go through the process of trying to figure out, and, you know, ideally, well, from what I heard, ideally everybody wants the big publishers that are going to do the marketing for you and do everything. But if you want to retain the rights to your book, self-publishing is the answer. I personally like self-publishing, you know, and I'm not saying if Simon & Schuster come and say, you know, we'll buy your book and we'll give you whatever. I don't know. I'm not, and it's not me saying, it's not ego saying that. I just don't know because, and I would love that, but, you know, I like the fact that I can retain the rights to my book. And now, and maybe at least in the beginning, maybe, you know, you have a period when you do that and hopefully the book blows up and then you can go for the big publishers. But right now, with a lot of the online, with Amazon, with everything like that, it's easier now to self-publish. It's easier.
Right.
And with social media, you are able to have more exposure than you would have years ago. So if somebody wants to, I mean, I'll say try self-publishing at first and then, you know, work as hard as you can. If you want it to blow up to the point where somebody's interested and looks at your book, then you go that route. Me personally, I feel like I can blow up without them, but
right.
I'm not going to say I'm not going to talk to them. But I personally don't feel for me that I need that in order for my book to be in 163 countries, which is my goal. I actually
right.
have a frame in my office that says 163 because the UN, I think, or 165, the UN recognizes 163 and 165 countries or something like that. 195, I think. So, sorry, whatever the number is, I have it in my office. And every day I look at it, and I just heard the other day that somebody in England bought my book. So I told my kids, I said, it's international now.
There
it was
you go.
One person, but still, it's in somebody in England. So I'm like, well, thank you very much.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I don't feel like I need that in order to be in all those countries. But, you
right.
know, it is a beautiful thing to have if you have somebody that, you know, big company that wants your book. It's a nice thing.
Right. Maya, we're getting near the end here. Got any
okay.
parting words that you would like to share or would you like to thank anybody out there? I'm sure there's several people. This is sort of your Academy Award winning time here. You get to tell everybody what you like about them and maybe what you don't like about them, but go ahead.
Okay. Thank you. Well, I have to start by thanking you, Tom. I mean, from the beginning, it's been a wonderful experience. You're professional. You're very competent. You're courteous. And, you know, you gave me the opportunity just, you know, as a new author. And again, it's a gift that you have to support authors. And I thank you for everything you went through, decided, that made you get to where you are right now. So it is an honor for me. Thank you so much. And,
you're very welcome.
I guess, there's certain people that gave me my first book signing. I had big book signings, and I had my publisher, of course, my publisher helped me connect with editors and everything like that and book cover people. So, I'm very grateful for Michael. He's listening, and I think, I hope. Uh-huh. And also, my children and my dog, Gino, have been my biggest fans, my biggest support. And again, my heart, I talk about my heart and so many other people, like friends and everything like that has been with me, not a lot of friends. I'm not, kind of more of a, loner type person, not loner, but I like a small crowd of
sure.
good friends and a big crowd, So, but, in the universe, of course, but not least my heart, because I did actually go to the hospital once, and the doctor was like, I don't know how you survive. You shouldn't really be here. And my heart was basically functioning with like less than minimum nutrients or whatever it needed. It was less than minimum. And people
wow.
said, people in my condition, in better condition, died all the time. And some of my family members at a medical field told me, people in better condition than you die all the time. I don't know how you did it. And it was operating with a very little oxygen. So I always say, I'm grateful for my heart not giving up at that time. And I remember being in the hospital and putting my hand on my heart. And I said, I promise you that I will fight for you as hard as you fought for me. And I always do whatever it takes to make sure that you have joy,
Very good.
And I did
Very
that,
good.
And I was so happy, So I thank my heart, I guess, lastly. But thank you so much, Tom. This has been awesome. And, I'm excited. I would like to talk to you in a couple of months and see, or maybe next year, and see what's going on.
Yes, we definitely will do that. And we'll look at your second book. And we're getting close
yes.
to the end here. And I just want to thank you again for being on the show. Maya, and it
Thank
was a
you,
pleasure,
Tom.
And we look forward to more from you in the future, and I'm sure you have helped a lot of people already, and we look forward to more people reading your book and being inspired by you and what you write. So you have a good night,
thank you
for being on the Writer's Lounge.
Can I just say, it's on Amazon, Apology to My Demons on Amazon. Buy it for you, buy it for somebody you love.
Very good. Take care, Maya.
Thank you, Tom. You too. Bye.
Bye-bye. And there goes Maya, and I hope you get out there and buy her book, and I'm sure she would enjoy that. And now it's the final chapter, and on Monday, January 24th, 2 weeks from tonight at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, Luke Romaine will be here with his book, Ash. It's a character that you won't soon forget. I know I will remember him for a very long time. Until then, see you next time on the Writer's Lounge, where we encourage writers and readers to keep the pen and eyes to the page and to let the story begin. Enjoy yourselves and be well, and good night.
If they asked me, I could write a book about the way you walk and whisper and look. I could write a preface on how we met, so the world would never forget. And the simple secret of the plot, it's just to tell you that I love you a lot. Then the world discovers, as my book ends, how to make